This is Let's Talk Tribe, the official Let's Go Tribe podcast, episode 56. They Got Edwin, with special guest Brian Heminger, recorded on January 2nd, 2017. Hello and welcome to Let's Talk Tribe, the official Let's Go Tribe podcast. As always, with your hosts, me, Matt Lyons, and Jason Lukart. Jason, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm happy to be writing 2017 on the checks that I don't actually have to write because I don't write checks, but I'm glad it's a new year.
Checks? What are those? Are those like really slow debit cards? Or I don't understand. And also joining us today is our lead prospect writer. I really should do official titles, but we'll call you lead prospect writer, Brian Heminger. Brian, how you doing?
I am doing terrific, and appreciate the invite onto the show tonight.
No problem. As we'll get to later, the main reason it kind of ties in now is that we're doing, if everybody didn't notice, our live prospect votes for the year, our top prospect lists are coming up here, and then tomorrow we're going to debut a new show with Brian on Facebook, which is just answering prospect questions, because Jason and I, as much as I watch them and still do the daily things, I don't know that much about them. And Jason is self-professed, doesn't follow prospect that much either. But we always get a lot of prospect questions, so I thought it'd be good to do kind of a show on its own. So that's what that'll be tomorrow. So thanks for joining us on this, too.
Oh, it's going to be a blast. I eat, sleep, and breathe prospects right now. So there aren't many people that checked every single box score of every single minor league team for the Indians in 2016. So...
Did you always do that before, or did that start this year when you were doing like the minor league recaps and just turned into a habit?
I didn't always used to do it. It started because I think like I was always drawn to Andrew Kinsman stuff on Let's Go Tribe. And then I would check those prospect articles every day when he was doing them, like, and he would update them at like 3 a.m. and it was a really bad night owl at the time. And I would be there as he was updating him live, and he thought I was just a crazy person, and I'd just be cool. Talking to him in the comments, and he'd be like, what are you doing here?
Yeah, Andrew's great. It's great. As hard as Jason tried, we couldn't keep him. Mm-hmm. He tried to pry him into Let's Go Tribe. He had to go. I think he was...
Shout out to Andrew's prospect work, because, yeah, he really put a lot of effort into it, into something that was never going to be my thing, and Ryan did a good job with it, but kind of like a good, this needs to be done, so I'm going to do it. Andrew was the first person, I think, who kind of had a little more passion for it, and then mm-hmm. Brian, as you just said, you know, has picked up on that, and so I think that's something Let's Go Tribe has been a lot better at in the last couple of years than it was before. It was prospect stuff.
I know at least Ryan did the, what was it called, like Prospects Worth Knowing or Prospects to
Prospects
Know?
That Matter, yeah, which yeah. was good.
Yeah, that was really
cool. I feel like it's been elevated a lot lately.
Yeah.
Yeah, and hopefully I'll be bringing a lot of interviews this year. So
yeah, that was one of my favorite things last year, too. Yeah, I don't know how you got all of those, but those are really cool.
Yeah, well, some of them you can do just by emailing back and forth with some of the media people, like handlers for each team. And I'm going to do some traveling this year and see if I can get a lot of in-person interviews. The only one I got in person last year was Adam Pletko. I talked to him in the dugout right before a Clippers game.
Oh, cool.
Which was really cool.
Who was the one where he said he was bored on Twitter and you're like, hey, do you want to do an interview for a website?
No, that was Joe Wyatt.
Jonas Wyatt.
Jonas Wyatt. He had been suffered from... He just had Tommy John surgery and he was bored. And I was like, hey, you want to talk to me? And he's like, okay.
I like to remind Jason that right after he left, Francisco Lindor, like Under Armour called. I'm like, do you want to interview Francisco Lindor? I'm like, sure. Yeah. And that was, I think, a week after Jason like took a hiatus after he gave the site over.
Real cool, Under Armour. Real cool.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for that one.
So let's get right into it. Not a ton of news, obviously, because it's the end of December and nobody wants to do anything, but it's, as Jason was saying before the podcast started, it feels like a long time ago now, but the Indians agreed to a deal with Edwin Encarnacion. 3 years, $65 million, which, in case you're still confused how that money breaks down, because I was for a while, it's 3 years, $60 million he gets on the deal no matter what. And then there's a fourth option for $20 million. If the Indians don't take it and they do the buyout, it's $5 million. So it's reported as 3 years, $65 million, because at the very least, that's what he's going to get. Otherwise, it's going to be 4 years, $80 million. But I can't imagine. We'll talk about that, but I can't imagine that he's taking that. And according to Paul Hoynes this week, he's supposed to come in and take his physical finally, and he'll make it official. That's the last hangup, apparently, is if he'd fail that physical, they wouldn't do the deal. But That's probably not going to happen, although I just probably jinxed
that,
it. But
that would be devastating.
So, yeah, Brian, are you excited about... I hope you're excited about Edwin Encarnacion coming to the Indians.
I'm ecstatic about Edwin Encarnacion. On Christmas Day, we were watching Sports Time Ohio for some reason, and they were replaying the Naquin Inside the Park game.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the whole game, and I'd forgotten some of the stuff in it. But Encarnacion comes up in like the eighth inning, and I know he's going to strike out or something. He's going to get out. And but they show his stats, and this is mid-August, and he was already better than Napoli.
Yeah.
His entire season. He was at like 34 home runs and like 108 RBIs in August. And then if you factor in that he strikes out like 60 times less, oh my goodness. Like I'm like a teenage girl. Like I just shaking and ooh, I can't wait to see Edwin Encarnacion in an Indians uniform.
Yeah. Getting Napoli was kind of like, okay, we have a right-handed power bat, I guess. This might be neat. But Edwin Encarnacion is like a legitimate, holy cow, he's really good. He could be really good for at least like two of these years. Like it could be incredible. Jason, are you a teenage girl over this deal too? Like we are?
I'm a teenage girl over a lot of things. I think it's a great signing for the Indians in that, they're already a good team, but someone who could take over Napoli's role and do what probably a better job of it. And a three-year deal isn't bad. I still don't think the Indians are financially in a position to sign someone as good as Encarnacion, who's a lot younger, to like a 7 or 8 year deal. So this is a good situation for them. The market for Encarnacion didn't develop quite as well as expected, which played right into the Tribe's hands. I think it was a great signing for them. I would point out, Brian mentioned the strikeouts, which are significantly lower than Napoli's, but his strikeout rate did spike quite a bit this year, which if you look at his numbers from 2012 to 2015, pretty incredible consistency, way more consistent than you usually see from a player. And then his numbers dipped a little bit in 2016, not his power, not his walk rate, but his strikeout rate shot up from about 15% to about 20%. So hopefully that's not a sign that his bat's slowing down. I mean, at his age, I wouldn't be surprised if he's mildly declining. But if he's mildly declining, this should work out really well for the Indians.
Is this the case where, because I know like Steamer, I'm pretty sure they have him going regressing quite a bit. Like they're just slamming the regress button there. Is he kind of just defying progression systems right now? Or is it going to happen? Is he going to crash before this contract is over probably?
Oh, I think almost certainly before the contract is over. Like you said, I mean, if he can be pretty close to the player he's been for another couple of years, and then if he were, to fall off more significantly in the third year, that would still, I think, be a big success for the Indians. There's room for a little decline in his numbers for him still to be well worth this contract.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, it's only a four-year deal. It's not – or three-year deal with the option for the fourth. I don't expect the Indians to pick up that fourth option unless he just rakes for the first 3 years. Then it would be worth it, but you probably don't need to worry about that fourth option. I'm expecting two really good years, and then we'll see what happens in that third. But I'm definitely not expecting a Nick Swisher part two, which maybe some people might be worried about.
Yeah, I'm glad the Indians weren't like fans and saying, well, Swisher and Bourne didn't work out, so we can't send anybody long-term anymore. They don't. That's not how front offices think. That's how fans think. So I'm glad for that. But let's turn that into a thing. Let's say, I know this is kind of, we didn't have this plan, so maybe you don't know off the top of your head, but how good would Encarnacion have to be for them to pick up that option? I think it's amazing they got that in the first place, because I imagine there's almost no way they take it. But would he have to have like three more years of like 42 home runs and his strikeouts stay low? And is there any chance the Indians take that no matter how good he is?
I think they take it. Or do they just
not take the risk?
I think they take it if his strikeouts don't spike like through the roof. If he stays at 20% or lower through this whole contract, then they're not worried about him just going up there and being an all or nothing guy. Then I think, why not? I mean, right now they have some really good power hitting guys on the rise in the minor system, but you don't need, I mean, you can still just have that mashing DH. And if he's mashing after year three, then why not take the fourth one? But yeah, he's going to have to mash the third.
I don't think 2017 and 2018 matter at all for the option year. I think it all just comes down to how he does in the third year. I mean, if he's fairly healthy in the third year, and is still an above average hitter, sure. I mean, at that point, do you want him on a 1 year deal at that point? And so, but yeah, I think by 2019, he'll have slowed down enough that, like you guys, I don't expect that they will exercise the option, but I don't think it's out of the question.
So we can use this as kind of a segue into the next section here, but do you think this contract is going to, going to make it more difficult to do other things, like maybe sign Francisco Lindor to a long extension or re-sign Carlos Santana or all these other core players that are getting older? Is this going to really stop them from doing anything like that? I think it's obviously going to stop them from signing any big free agents for a couple of years, but what about retaining the guys they have? Do you think they went into this planning for it and knowing they can still do it with Encarnacion, or is this kind of shorting themselves in the future to get the wins now?
The only player I think it really, whose future I think it has really any impact on in terms of, it would be Santana. You know, Santana's going into his last year. I think probably, you know, he's gone after this year, which saddens me because I love Santana. But otherwise, no, I don't think it does anything to affect their ability to sign guys to, you know, long-term extensions. Because you're somewhere in your paperwork, you're planning money for those guys anyway. So no, like you said, I think it means we're not going to see them add any other big free agents. But I don't think it really affects anyone but Santana, who's, in terms of guys already with the team.
Yeah.
And another thing you do have to factor in is if the Indians are as good as I think they're going to be over the next couple years, then, you know, attendance should be way up, especially as this season after them making the World Series and Game 7 and everything. I think they're going to be bringing in a lot more money too. So maybe that can also help with giving some extensions out there too. But I definitely think that Lindor and Ramirez they're working on it right now on just trying to figure out what they could make work for both guys. But Jason said, I completely agree. Santana's gone, especially with a couple of those sluggers they have on the rise, like Nelly Rodriguez and Bobby Bradley. There's really no room for Santana, especially with the amount of money he's probably going to be commanding after this season.
Yeah, and before we dive completely into Lindor extension talk, I want to put on a tinfoil hat and put on a tinfoil shin guards and carry a tinfoil shield and say maybe the Indians knew that Michael Brantley isn't completely healthy. That's why they're okay with giving Encarnacion this money to kind of cancel out his bat. They know they won't pick up his option. Is that too tinfoil hatty, or is that maybe a possibility, Jason?
I think it's a possibility, but I don't think Brantley's option. Again, I don't think it's the determining factor. In other words, I think the Indians are certainly aware of the possibility they might not pick up Brantley's option, but I don't think that's the reason they felt comfortable going out and giving Encarnacion this contract.
Yeah, I think they're just in win now mode. They've got so much talent. They have Andrew Miller for two more years. Why not just go for it? And Encarnacion was the guy to get. That filled the biggest hole that they had from a free agency that they'd lost.
Yep. Isn't that a great feeling too? I mean, I'm all for making like smart, like Rajai Davis and Mike Napoli signings, but it's awesome to like do this big, it looks like it's going to work at least for a couple of years kind of signing thing. I mean, we could be the Reds right now talking about that, but we get to talk about the Indians winning things.
It feels like the 90s a little bit. Like you've got that great core that you build up. Maybe you got a little lucky with, and then boom, you just add in a couple of those, you know, high powered free agents to supplement the team. And I think Edwin Encarnacion is really going to supplement this team.
Yep. So Jason, I wanted to talk about a post you did earlier this week. I can't even remember what it was. This whole like between Christmas and New Year's, it's a blur and just like nothing makes sense and there's no such thing as days. But at one point you wrote about the idea of Francisco Lindor taking an extension after a lot of words and a lot of thought. It was a really great post. You've eventually came down to 6 years, $55 million, which would probably get him. So just talk about that more, because I know we've had people ask the podcast specifically about signing Lindor to an extension. Do you think there's any chance of this happening? And do you just want to go into detail about how you came to that number?
Well, I definitely think there's a chance of it happening. The Indians have been arguably the most aggressive team in signing players to extensions, and for good reason, because they know they're not going to be in the market to keep a lot of those guys once they hit free agency. So being able to lock them up for a couple years beyond free agency well in advance. You know, there's risk involved there, but the Indians have shown that's a risk they're willing to take. So I'm certain, you know, the Indians are looking into that. That's what they did with Santana. That's what they did with Brantley, with Kipnis, with Yan Gomes, with Kluber, with Carrasco, and, you know, on a much, much smaller scale with guys like Josh Tomlin. So I definitely think they're looking into it. And of course, then it just comes down to how much interest is there from the player. In terms of how I came up with the numbers, like, so Lindor's under control through 2021 right now. And so the Indians can do absolutely nothing, but they can pay him the league minimum the next couple of years. And then he'll be in arbitration for 2019, 20, and 21. And I estimated through research and looking into similar players' arbitration payments that he'd cost about $40 million for those 5 years if they just go year to year. And then at the end of those 5 years, then you're looking at someone who probably costs, if he keeps playing about how he played last year, you're looking at someone who's going to get a $200, $250 million contract, which the Indians are not going to be the team who gives out that contract. So that's the logic behind signing him. In terms of coming up with the numbers, I just tried to find other players in recent years who signed contracts at the same point. Paul Goldschmidt's the best player who signed a contract like that. And there aren't that many guys. So you don't have a huge number of other cases to look at. But looking at the other cases, and I've done this before Kluber signed and before Kipnis signed, and I think I have a pretty good track record with being close to it. I was criticized for Kluber with, oh, you're way low. He would never agree to a deal like that. You're way off on this. And then he actually signed for a little less than I estimated. So I stand by my numbers. And yeah, I think 6 years, $55 million with the team option that would bring it to 7 years, $70 million is about what it would take. And that would give the Indians a couple extra years of team control. Whether it happens or not, I don't know. When I posted it, a couple of people said, like, oh, let's wait. I want the Indians to wait one more year and just kind of see. The thing is, every year you wait, the more expensive the deal gets, of course, because he's that much closer to free agency and the big payday, so you don't get the same discount. So I'd love to see the Indians get it done right now.
Yeah, I think anecdotally, like, fans, they undervalue the contract of, I mean, am I getting it backwards here? Like, big free agents, they think they'll sign for less. And, like, young players, they think, oh, they're a star. They should sign for a ton of money, even though they're under team control. But that last part is the big part, is that they're under team control. The team doesn't have to pay them, so they usually make a lot less than fans think they're worth, which is just kind of how it works. Because if you're, like, Lindor's age, if you're 22 and you're staring, like, $60 million in the face, it's kind of hard to say no, considering, like, any day you could break your leg and arm and neck in the same horrific injury and be done.
Yeah, well, and the other thing people said was, well, no, the Indians should go for more years than that. They should, like, sign him for, like, 10 years. But I don't think Lindor would do that. I think an extra couple years has sort of been, like, the norm for contracts like this. And Lindor, because he came up relatively young, he could sign the hypothetical deal I mentioned, play through the full 7 years of it. And he'd still be 29 years old when he hit free agency. So he'd still be in line for a huge payday because he'd be young enough that teams would be willing to go, you know, 7 or 8 years on him. And again, this is all dependent on him continuing to play well, of course. But I don't think he'd sign like a 10-year deal because at that point, then you're pushing him, you know, he's 32 and now he's not going to get that massive deal. So the amount you'd have to give him extra in those 8th, 9th, and 10 years I don't think would really be a discount in anything at that point. So I don't think the 10-year deal is realistic. I don't think a 5-year deal makes any sense because it doesn't extend the Indians' control of them. So I think, you know, 6 years with an option, a team option for the 7th is the sweet spot.
No, I think I have the solution. Maybe 10-year is too much. Well, it's not that it's too much. It's digging into those years and then he's worried about what kind of deal he'd get when he ends it. How about a 15-year deal? And then, you know, he's 37 when he's done, and then we just make it like $250 million or something crazy. 15 years.
You're getting into the Giancarlo Stanton deal. His was $325.
You can't say he's not worth it. Just saying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, lifetime contract works for me. I'd be fascinated to know what number it would take for him to sign a contract, you know, through, I don't know, his age, you know, 40 season or something like that. I'd be fascinated to know what kind of number it would take to do something like that.
Yeah, me too. It'd be a lot, I'm sure.
This is like a side tangent. The Indians, unless I'm forgetting someone, I don't think in my life the Indians have had like an actual career Indians player. You know, not counting guys who played for like 4 or 5 years and then, you know, sort of burned out. I don't think there's been a guy with like a 10 plus year career who was on the Indians his whole career. It'd be fun.
I'd say the closest is Nagy.
Yeah, because he played like, you know, 3 months, I think, not with Indians. You're right. I think he's the closest, but I don't think there is one.
Yeah, all the stars of the 90s, they all went other places at some point.
And it's not to say that's just like an Indians thing. I don't, you know, there just aren't that many players like that anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, the Yankees had a whole bunch of them sort of at once. You know, the Astros had Bagwell and Biggio basically at the same time. You know, Chipper Jones, Todd Helton. There have been other ones. But not a ton, and it'd be neat for the Indians to have one. I don't think they will, but I'd be fascinated to know what dollar number it would take for Lindor to say, like, yep, I will always be here. And then at some point, he would fade in Indians fans and be like, oh, my God, why are we stuck with Francisco for 4 years?
You know that happened, of course.
Yeah. Yes, it definitely would
happen. Okay, make your team option year 14 and 15.
There we go. Smooth it out a little bit. So to take your other tangent on another tangent, I think it's kind of – I don't know, funny, sad, or ironic that Mark Shapiro, he had to dismantle the 90s Indians teams in the early 2000s, and now he has to do the same thing with the Blue Jays. He's kind of like unfairly having, he just comes in at those times when they have to do it. I don't think he really has a choice, and he's just stuck with it both times. But he made something here, and maybe he will in Toronto. It's just, it's like seeing the exact same reactions in Toronto as we saw in Cleveland for so long about him. I think he knows what he's doing. It's just like he comes in at a fortunate time.
They offered Encarnacion a pretty fair deal.
Yeah, the same deal he got without the option.
Yeah.
That was all him and his agent, I think.
Yep.
Unless he just really didn't want to go back for some reason. I don't know. But I can't imagine
I do remember reading something about, like, the Encarnacion was sort of rubbed the wrong way about something about how the offer was made or something like that. Now, I don't know if that's Shapiro or, you know, who that falls on or if there's even anything to it. But I did hear, and I don't have a source to quote or a link to provide or anything, but that he was sort of turned off by things.
I'm going to blame Jose Bautista.
Yeah, I'm sure he was rubbed the wrong way by the fact that they signed Morales like within a couple days of him turning down that offer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, part of me got to know if he turned it down, they've got to move on and do something. But it seems like he was hoping they would counter something. Yeah. And people compare it to the John Lester situation a couple years ago, but he was just completely lowballed with his. This was just something different entirely, I think. I don't think he was lowballed at all. And he did just kind of get screwed out because of the market, too. If it was like... I don't know, for as good as he is, I think the Indians got him on a great deal. I don't think there's any way you can argue that, but it was kind of unfortunate for him, just the way the market dried up all of a sudden, and good for the Indians. So maybe he'll be great for 3 more years and he can have another big deal, I don't know. But this was probably his one shot at a big deal, and he got a decent one, I think, but a deal for the Indians.
Yeah, we don't need any tears for Edwin Encarnacion's financial outlook.
Yeah, I think he'll be okay. He'll make it. So Brian, I want to put you on the ultimate spot for a minute, because I didn't mention this before, and you're just going to have to guess in the dark here, but pick one prospect that in a couple years, the Indians should consider giving him like a lifetime, or not a lifetime contract, but this kind of like early extension for Lindor. Who's going to be so good when they first come up that they might require it?
I think it's going to be Tristan McKenzie. Really do. I think that's the one you keep your eye on. The way that this kid is just blowing everyone away at every level he's played so far. I mean, it's eye-popping. I'm extremely excited about Tristan McKenzie. I think I don't think he's quite going to beat CC Sabathia's age when he makes his Indians debut, but I think he's going to be close, and I think he's not going to look back once he gets up here either.
The selfish side of me is glad that he's going up the rank because I can watch him on MLB TV easier. Like the couple games I saw of him in Lake County were amazing. Yeah. So when he gets to like double A and triple A and we can see him every start, it's going
to
be incredible.
And he's already stretched out so that he can pitch 6+ innings for this upcoming season. And I don't think he's even 20 years old yet, or maybe I think he's still 19. I mean, this kid is special. It looks like his curveball, his changeup, his fastball. I mean, he looks really, really good. I think the Indians got really lucky with that one.
So he's going to be one that gets the, at least we'll be talking about it in a couple years, you think?
Yeah. I mean, he's going to be the one that's going to be pushing some of our pitchers for playing time are starters for sure. Like, people are gonna be like calling for him whenever like a veteran has a bad game.
That never happens, Brian. People are always so level-headed about prospects when they should come up. They always want them to be patient and take their time and develop them every time, right? So from that, let's go to our next section here. We're going to do our top five prospects for 2017. Because like I said before, right now we're running our community vote. You can find them every morning at 10. They're going to post. And you can vote all the way through the night. Tonight's first one is already done. Francisco Mejia won by quite a lot. I was a little surprised by that. He beat Bradley Zimmer out for the number one prospect. Brian, were you shocked at all by that Mejia, with his big hit streak, overtook last year's number one prospect?
I'm not too shocked. I mean, Baseball America came out and they had Mejia number one over Zimmer. And Zimmer, as he did have a good season last year. People, you know, talking like he regressed and did terrible. The only thing that he really had an issue with last year were the strikeouts, which skyrocketed in the toughest transition that you make at AA, AAA. And but yeah, Mejia, with him being number one in Baseball America, and then with the 50-game hit streak, I mean, all eyes were on Mejia. Like, he was by far the prospect that got the most traction with us last season. And yeah, I wasn't surprised at all that that our readers would vote for him over Zimmer.
Yep. What about you, Jason? Were you surprised at all with that?
No, I mean, both because of this, you know, the season he had, and also, I mean, you know, Baseball America and stuff like that, but also the season he had. My experience in having been around for a few of these is Let's Go Tribe readers tend to be more swayed by the previous season than, you know, other outlets. And so, the fact that other outlets have them really, really close, and Mejia had the season that got as much attention as it did, I expected him to come out on top in the LGT voting.
Yep. So do you want to go first with your top five, Brian? Or Brian, Jason?
No, I don't.
I figured we would let Brian go last, but how about we let Brian go first instead, and then we'll just give our
I'll go first. I got no problem with that. Number one, I'll go Mejia. I'm fine with that. I think, personally, he might be, now that Moncada's probably going to be starting for the White Sox, I think Mejia might be the best catching prospect in all of baseball, especially offensively. I mean, he's got the cannon arm, he's got the hitting, he's got the eye at the plate, low strikeout rate. I mean, everything seems to be looking really good for him. We'll learn a lot this year with him jumping up to AA, because, again, that is the toughest transition in all of minor league baseball. But I think he's going to pass it with flying colors. But wouldn't shock me to see a slow start. I mean, he did take two seasons, or he repeated this past year at single A. People might forget that. But, yeah, I think Mejia's number one for me. Number two, this might surprise you, but I'm going McKenzie. I really am so high on this kid. It's a lot more on potential. I mean, Zimmer is, I think, a really great prospect. I have him at three. But with McKenzie, I am so high on this kid. I really think the world of him. I mean, the fact that he moved up from low A to single A last season, and his numbers got way better, like strikeout rate, walk rate. The only thing that he had a little trouble with was he got a little tired. He gave up some runs in like the fourth and fifth innings of all his starts. But innings one through three, I mean, he just mowed people down. And he's like 2 or 3 years younger than the average age. I mean, it's just crazy. So so it's Mejia, McKenzie, Zimmer, and then I have Yandy Diaz, number four, and then number five, Bobby Bradley.
Wow, Diaz is pretty high.
Yeah, I am a big fan of Diaz. I really think he makes the Indians' starting roster out of spring training this year. I mean, he is major league ready. There is no player in the entire Indian system that is major league ready offensively as Yandy Diaz. I mean, the guy has one of the best eyes in all the minor leagues. His contact rate is through the roof. His power is improving. And he can play all three outfield positions plus third base and second base. I think he's going to be kind of like the Jose Ramirez, maybe a little Jose Ramirez light from 2016. I think he has the potential to do that.
Wow. So it's not just the fact that he's almost ready. It's that he's so good and he just happens to almost be ready to come up. It gives him a little boost, but that's good. So Jason, would you rather go second or last?
I'll squeeze mine into the middle. I'm not going to provide the commentary because, I mean, it's largely the same guys, and I don't have well thought out reasons for having slightly different order. I'll stick with Zimmer at top, which even as I'm saying that, I don't feel like it means I think he's like a fantastic prospect. I had Clint Frazier ahead of him. But I guess for me, I still think of Zimmer as the top guy, just a little ahead of then Mejia at number two. And then, like Brian, I share his excitement about Tristan McKenzie. I'm a little terrified that he's still listed as 6'5", 165 pounds, which
he
is
looks not it too.
Right height to weight ratio. So I hope he puts a little meat on his bones. That's like me in college skinny, which does not feel like... But I guess that's also like Chris Sale, so I guess you can look at it that way. But yeah, I mean, I really like McKenzie too and would have him at number three. And then I would have Bradley at number four, and I'd have Brady Aiken at number five. And I know, you know, he's a little more up in the air and didn't do much this season. But just coming off Tommy John surgery, I still view him as someone with the potential to be a really good player.
Yeah, I have him. So before I get to mine, Brian, was there a reason you left him out of your top five, Brady Aiken?
For me, I probably have him at six or seven. No real reason. Just the main thing was the question marks with the Tommy John, and then his numbers weren't that good this year. I know it's his return year. You don't expect to go out there and light the world on fire. And he did get better when they promoted him to low A, so I'm happy for that. And if he starts the season at single A, I think that would be great. And then we'll see how he performs. And he could definitely rise in mine. But mine's more on I need to see him have a little bit more success against some hitters. Right now, he's not fooling a lot of guys yet. So I dropped him a little bit. But the potential is definitely still there.
Yeah, for sure. So mine, as unexciting as it is basically Jason's in a different order, slightly different order. Like him, I have Bradley Zimmer number one. I think you're both crazy, though. I still think he's a great prospect. I believe in White Lightning. I mean, the power is still there, obviously. He strikes out a ton. I hope he'll work on that. He had the hand injury late in the season. When he was getting into the rhythm, he had the injury and it kind of slowed him down. And there isn't a whole lot of positive reports on his defense, but what's there is really good. So I'm kind of leaning towards those. Maybe that's being optimistic, but I've seen him play defense in person and I've seen a bunch of games. I think he's better than some of these negative reports have coming out. Even if he's not in center field, like one of the corners, I still think he's a good prospect there. Number two, Tristan McKenzie, because like you, Brian, I'm just high on it. It's so fun to watch. I can't wait to see him go up higher. He's just completely unhittable in everything I've seen. I'm hoping to see a game by him in person soon when he plays. Like, basically, I have to drive 2 hours to see a minor league game. So I'm hoping he starts soon around there so I can go see him in person, because that's got to be something to witness. Francisco Mejia, number three. The reason I don't have him higher is just I want to see him do that season again without the 50-game hit streak. I know it's kind of bad to just discount the whole thing because of that, which I'm not doing, but I have him a lot higher because he did so well this year. But I just want to see him do it again for another year. Then I will be truly extremely excited about Mejia. Number four, Brady Aiken. Maybe high, I don't know, but like you said, he did better when he got promoted. I didn't really believe in those early reports that he looked terrible. The Indians were worried. I think those were exaggerated. He's coming back from Tommy John. I think he's still got the potential there. The ceiling isn't damaged at all. He could still get there, I think. The only problem is his floor is like rock bottom. If there is a lot of problems going on with him, he's going to be a busted prospect. But right now, I don't think it's worth worrying about yet. Mm-hmm. And then five, Bobby Bradley. And I even kind of struggled to put him at five. I mean, I like the power, but I don't know. There's still just so many strikeouts with him. He just seems like a guy who's going to hit the ball really hard and maybe not do a whole lot else. I could be wrong, yeah. But I still have a number five. I
see him being a repeat of Mike Napoli.
Yeah.
Except maybe having a little more power potentially.
Or maybe even a lot more power.
His walk rate is really good. That is one thing to keep an eye on moving forward.
Yeah. But that's the one I considered having somebody else, but nobody else. I mean, like, I considered Diaz too, but like Bradley, I just squeezed him in there, but it's like a five if... five, almost six kind of thing. But still, a really good power prospect, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So another kind of minor league thing I want to talk to you about, and Jason too, Nelly Rodriguez didn't get picked in the Rule 5 draft. He was out there, nothing. He wasn't taken. Any idea why?
For me, I think the reason he didn't get taken is the position. You know, if he gets taken, he has to stay on a 40-man or 25-man roster all season, and... there's not a lot of utility with a first base exclusive guy. So, there's a lot of teams that keep an extra guy on the roster. Not many of them keep an extra first base only guy on the roster. So that's my guess. And they didn't feel that he would be able to start for him. So I'm totally fine with that. I still think Nelly Rodriguez is very good, and I expect him to make his debut at some point with the Indians this year. Maybe somebody with an injury, or it could just wait until the call-ups. But yeah, I think that that's the main reason.
So do you think they didn't protect him because they didn't think he'd be taken, or they just were okay with him being taken because he's kind of redundant with Bobby Bradley in there? Although Bradley, of course, is older or younger, but so like, were they worried about, they weren't worried about him being taken, or they just didn't think he would be?
I think they didn't think he'd be taken.
Calculated risk.
They felt the same way, I'm sure, about Anthony Santander, and then he did get taken, which I was not happy about. I thought he had the best offensive season of any Indian in any level last year, and now he's on the Orioles, and last year they proved that they are extremely stubborn, because they drafted a guy and they just left him on the bench the whole season and kept him.
Team loves the Rule 5 draft like the Orioles.
Yeah, so they drafted two guys, though, so they have to keep them both. And if Santander's shoulder gets better and they take him off the DL, then he has to be on there for a good amount this season. So we'll see what happens with that. I really hope we get Santander back. I think that kid has a lot of potential.
I think it was Andrew Kinsman in the comments. He was driving the point home that that's the reason they drafted him. Like, people are saying they're surprised they took him because he's injured, but that's why you take that player, because
he can be on the DL. From what I heard, they didn't know he was injured when they drafted him.
Orioles.
That's very Orioles. I read something that they did not know he was hurt, but they're like, we got him now.
How do you not know that? Are they just like
the Orioles, man? Like, they have the worst minor league system. Like, they when they drafted him, the Orioles, Santander was number 30 in the Indian system. Now, obviously, he would have gone up when they updated the MLB prospectus rankings. He probably would have jumped into the at least 10 spots, I would think, after his season. But even without them doing the major update based on his most recent season, he jumped up from 30 in the Indians to number 15 in the Orioles rankings. And I'm sure he would go even higher when they update it. So that's how bad the Orioles system is, though. Like, it is devoid of major talent, except at the very, very tip top.
That is truly the most Orioles thing I've ever heard. Drafting a player in the Rule 5 draft. I can't forget. I don't remember who wrote it, but somebody wrote a thing about just like how much they love the Rule 5 draft, like more than anybody on the team. They draft so many players every year, and
I thought it was crazy because I mean, he's never even played Double A, and now he's going to be on their major league roster, and he has to stay there. And if he is hurt, and they keep him on the 60-day DL most of the season, he has to play 100 days on the 25-man roster next season. So it's not like they can just stash him and then they keep him. There is a little bit of stuff that they can't just cheat the system.
So, Jason, any other thoughts on prospects or lists or Rule 5 drafts or the stupid Orioles? Or?
I mean, it's funny to laugh at him, but at the same time, like, what's the penalty for returning a player? Like $50,000 or something?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Grab a bunch of guys, send most of them back. You're at $250,000. Every once in a while, you find someone who works. I say good on Baltimore. I'm researching something with a $50,000 tag that's nothing to a major league team. Just grab some guys who've got some numbers. You can look at the medical reports later. The Orioles always look at the medical reports later.
You keep talking like that, you're going to get hired by the Orioles.
I'm really rooting for the Orioles to bring back Trumbo, so that way it crowds their outfield and just their bench a little more. And then hopefully if they get to the choice where they have to decide which prospect they have to send back, they would send back the one that's not healthy. So that's my dream, is that the Orioles, because they do have two outfield guys they drafted in the Rule 5. So I'm hoping that Santander, being so inexperienced right now, they send him back, because I really think that they could do some damage to him if like, just working with their system. They do not seem to have a system that's great at developing talent. So I don't want him over there for that long.
So let's go to social media questions. Every Monday, usually around noon, I'll ask on Twitter and Facebook for questions. If you see that, you can come up, ask, do whatever. You can email us, message us, I don't care. People in the comments now, live on Facebook, you can ask us something. If you're listening to the podcast, obviously, I mean, you can ask, just say it out loud. We won't answer, but you'll get weird looks. But yeah, so let's answer some questions. So first, we're going to go to Merritt Rolfing, who's one of our writers, if you didn't know. He's been on the podcast a couple times before. I'm sure he will be in the future. But he wanted to know, should the Indians change their name back to the Broncos? If you guys didn't see, I think it was Cleveland Scene Magazine that their whole like redesign the tribe thing. They had a whole bunch of submissions. Some were good, some were bad. What about the Broncho? I don't know. Is that just Broncos or is it Bronchos? There's an H in there.
Yeah, I have no idea what the H is.
I pretty much pronounced Broncos just with like the weird old-timey spelling of the era.
So what is that even from?
I'm against going back to the name Broncos. I'm all in favor of every major league team getting some weird old-timey sort of misspelled version of its name, though.
Well, the Broncos is pretty cool looking. It's just blue and white, which I like. Oh, they've worn those uniforms before. As long as they don't ever wear it's the one with like the collar, those awful uniforms. As long as they don't wear those, I'm okay with being, I don't care. Just don't wear the collared uniforms.
Well, when they had Napoli, they could have briefly become the Cleveland Naps again.
There you go. Nobody's mentioned that before. I don't know why. That seemed like it'd be so obvious, but I never heard anybody mention that. But yeah, they could have been the Naps just for a short time and then never again. Were they the Naps after Nap LaJoy left at all? Or was it just when he was there?
I think it was just when he was there. Like, just because he was, you know, such a big deal and he was such a good player. And I think it was when he was coaching them, too. Like, it wasn't just when he was on the team. He was the player manager.
Well, team names were a lot more fluid back then. And, like, it's not like teams even had their team name on their jersey. It was usually just the city. And the name was just, like, what the newspapers referred to them or fans. Yeah. A lot of teams, their names bounced around a lot back then.
Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of teams named the Giants way back in the day.
Right.
But I've been rewatching Ken Burns baseball and like teams from like 1890 to like 1915, like half of them were the Giants.
Yeah. Well, Cleveland was to not stick with the name after he left. 1914 was his last season with the team, and then 1915 is when they became Indians. And even before they were Naps and Broncos, they were the Cleveland Blues for their first year of existence. In
what about the Spiders?
That was before Spiders
were like a separate franchise.
Oh, okay. Oh, really? I knew they were really bad. Really bad.
Yeah. Yes, they went under for being like the worst team in professional baseball history.
Yep. Well, like the owner went to another team and just took all the players, didn't he? I think he went to the White Sox or something.
Yeah, he owned
like that was the big thing that like happened.
A St. Louis team. Anyway,
yeah,
it's a good story that we could do like a whole thing on someone who like Yo Daddy Wags knows a lot about it would be a good person to talk to. Yeah. But I want Chief Wahoo gone. And I understand like the problems with having any sort of logo while the team name is Indians. And at the same time, I sort of don't want them to change the name just because for sort of the same stupid reasons that a lot of people want to keep Chief Wahoo.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, then it would be like a different team, which is dumb. If they do change names, I don't want them to go back to one of the earlier ones.
Yeah.
But I don't mind them getting rid of Chief Wahoo, but I think you can keep Indians. I mean, I think the name Indians is actually now like a recognized term for Native Americans. So it's not like it's, you know, super offensive or anything. I mean, it's silly because they thought they were from India. But it's a recognized term. It's not like we're calling them Redskins. So
right,
who would do that?
Or so anyway. Savages or something.
So Mayor also asked another question. He wanted to know, when will the Indians have an all-time winning record against the Tigers, if ever? So if you want a literal answer, according to Baseball Reference, the Indians are 1,071 and 1,112 against the Tigers. So it's a 41 games they have to make up. And so this season they were 14-4 against the Tigers. So if they have 4.1 more seasons like this, then they'll at least tie. There's your completely literal answer. But do you guys think they ever will actually?
That's just a literal hypothetical way things could play out. Literal answer makes it sound like that's what's going to happen.
Well, no, I mean, yeah.
Then you're right. They need to make up 41 games.
Yeah, that's the literal part.
Yes.
Right.
I don't know. 41's a lot to make up. I'd be interested to know what the Indians' like best 5-year record against the Tigers, you know, at any given time is. I feel like, I won't say never, but if we talk again in 10 years, I don't think they'll have made up those 41 games.
I would say sometime like the late 90s, like from 98 or 99 to like 2003 or 2004, they did really good because those were the god-awful Tigers teams that were like setting loss records in a season and stuff, right?
Those are the best.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that was the time that they had the best stretch.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure from like 94 to 2004 for like an 11-year stretch, yeah. They did really. The Indians were probably like 150 games back at that point and made a lot of it up.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. But the Tigers were half decent in the mid-90s. Like they had, you know, Travis Fryman and Alan Trammell and those guys.
I wonder how close the Indians were like 6 years ago before the Tigers had the really good stretch. It was probably pretty close for a little while. It'd be interesting, and if I had the time, which I don't, someone could put it together. But just for the teams they've played the most, to look at the rise and fall of their winning percentage. I did the same thing. I went to Baseball Reference and looked things up. The Indians, their highest win total is against the Twins/Senators. They've beaten them 1,127 times. But their best winning percentage against any team they've played, you know, at least a couple hundred times, is against the Orioles. They're 1,125 and 860 against the Orioles. So they are 265 games up on Baltimore. I don't think Baltimore, I sure hope Baltimore doesn't make up 265 games on them in my lifetime.
Yeah, I hope not. That'd be an awful stretch of like a decade. And after all the smack talking we do on Baltimore, even if it's just in fun, but that'd be kind of like karma, I think. It'd be all our fault if it happened. So next question, Douglas L. Srod on Facebook. He wants to know, I'm curious about the outfield situation. Is what's present enough? Is the answer in the farm somewhere? Will Rajai pay for $5? I don't think Rajai will pay for $5. I wish, because I'd love to have him back for $5. Even a little, maybe a little more than $5. But so just basically to summarize real quick, and I'll let you guys answer. So what's present is Amante Naquin, Chisenhall, Guyer, Brantley, maybe? Ramirez, maybe? that's basically what we have in the outfield right now. So Brian, is there anything in the farm like that can help? We're talking like immediately. That would mean the Indians don't have to sign anybody. That kind of immediate help.
Yeah, I know the answer. obviously, Yandy Diaz can play any outfield position, and he's a good, solid right-handed bat. So I wouldn't, and he's been playing some center field, a lot of center field lately in the Venezuelan League, where he's currently batting like .380 through the whole season. I mean, just mashing over there. And so I think Yandy Diaz can come in immediately and give people a spell, or say somebody's struggling, he might just be able to take over center field. Or if Michael Brantley's hurt, he could play left field. So I definitely think Yandy can help. I expect Zimmer to be playing at some point this year once he, you know, maybe make some adjustments with his strikeout rate. And Greg Allen is knocking on that door. Keep an eye on Greg Allen. I honestly think he is the center fielder of the future. I know this is crazy, but I think he really could be like a Kenny Lofton, like a leadoff hitter, perfect guy at the top of the lineup.
At least we're not selling him too short, right?
Yeah, exactly. I know that I get a little overexcited sometimes about these prospects.
No, I'm okay with that.
This guy is a switch hitter with a crazy on-base rate, massive, super quick, a lot of steals, and he's the best defensive center fielder in all of minor league baseball. So I wouldn't be shocked to see Greg Allen, even though he finished last year in Double-A and didn't play the whole season there, maybe not even half the season. I wouldn't be shocked if he made it onto the Indians roster at some point by the end of the season. Like if he plays as good as I think he's going to play.
So one that I forgot too, Michael Martinez. Can't forget him. Mm-hmm. He's the mix for the outfield. Known center fielder.
Does have a minor league contract right now. But yeah, I honestly, I do think that the Indians can fill the gaps right now with their prospects. They have like, and Eric Gonzalez can play outfield. I don't know if they'll want to do that. I view him more as an infield utility guy, but he can play outfield. So he's in the mix as well. But I think the main guy is Yandy. Like, I'm really excited about Yandy.
Yeah. So assuming nobody comes up, nobody else is signed, Jason, is what they have enough? Yeah. Those ones that I listed?
Yes. What they have is enough. all they're losing from the year that they made Game 7 of the World Series is Rajay Davis. And he had a nice season. He was not the difference between them winning division and not winning the division. Best case scenario, Michael Brantley comes back something close to form, and that's a huge addition. More likely scenario, he comes back but is not his old self, and the outfield is not fantastic, but the pitching is really good. The infield is really good. The Indians ought to be the best team in the division, whether they add anyone else to the outfield or not, which is good because they're not going to add anyone significant to the outfield.
I know we already said that Edwin's going to prevent him from making big signings, but do you think there's any chance Rajai comes back? Because it doesn't seem like anybody really wants him. Maybe the Orioles kind of do, but does he get swept up on another cheap deal by the Indians, or do you think they can't even afford that right now?
I mean, I think they could afford him on the deal he signed. I mean, someone's going to sign him for more than he got last year. I know it hasn't happened yet, but spring training is also still 6 weeks away. Someone's going to sign him.
Yeah, I agree. Somebody's going to sign him, and I don't know if the Indians want six guys that play exclusively outfield on their roster at the same time. So I think they're five is pushing it, and then they'll probably go five with a utility.
So our final question, we'll wrap it up, from at Ryan Floor 4 on Twitter. He wants to know the best Indians pitcher of the following: CC Sabathia, Corey Kluber, or Cliff Lee. Jason, I'll let you take this one first if you want.
It's not Cliff Lee. I think Cliff Lee among those three guys is a pretty distant third place, which is not to say Cliff Lee didn't do a lot. But when you look at what Cliff Lee did for the Indians, I think a lot of what he did after he left the Indians gets included in people's memories. I mean, he had the completely deserved Cy Young season, and another year and a half of really good performance. But I think Sabathia and Kluber are pretty clearly ahead of him. I would still put Sabathia on top, but I think if Kluber has one more year that's something like his last 3 years have been, I think 2017 could be the year Kluber passes Sabathia.
Yeah, and basically the only research I did on this question was what you talked about, Cliff Lee. So his first 6 years with the Indians, he was worth a combined 8.1 Fangraphs WAR. All of his value with the Indians came in the last year and a half right before he got traded. It was 10.2 mm-hmm. in those last 2 years. Other than that, he was not – I mean, he was really good, but he wasn't the great Cliff Lee everybody associates with, I think. So my answer is going to be Kluber because – he's Corey Kluber. Like, if he has two more seasons like he has now, he's under contract to 2021, so he could do it. So if he has just a couple more seasons like he's had the past three, I think he's already passed Sabathia, too.
I will say right now, Sabathia, only because Corey Kluber has really only had three full seasons with the Indians. I mean, the first two were just small sample size, but he's had three really good seasons, and then the last two were, like, Cy Young. Well, the last three were really good, but he's really only had the three full seasons and one that was maybe three quarters of a season. So if he can go out and have one more really good season, I'd get him past CC. But we had CC for a while. He won a Cy Young. He was kind of our workhorse during that stretch in the mid 2000s. So I've got CC ahead of him right now. But if Kluber gives one more season like he did last year, then I think he passes him.
And not that there's a single number that can tell this, and so I'm not claiming that's what WAR does, but just to kind of give some things some context, if you use one version of WAR or another to compare these guys, Sabathia had 27.5 at Baseball Reference. Kluber's at 18.9. That's a significant difference of almost 9 WAR. I mean, Kluber's not going to make that difference up this year, and it's pretty much the same at Fangraphs. Baseball Prospectus has him a lot closer. Sabathia is only 2 ahead of him there.
Is that all with the Indians, though, or is that including after he left?
No, yeah, just with the Indians.
Wow, I didn't realize the gap was that big.
But, you know, there's also wins above average. You know, a lot of Sabathia's value comes from he's, like you guys are saying, he spent a lot more time with the Indians. Wins above average sort of doesn't count anything that's just kind of roughly average production. And Sabathia's only 2 wins above average ahead of Kluber. So Kluber's not going to catch Sabathia on WAR this year, maybe not in another 2 years, hopefully in another 2 years, but not necessarily. But one more good year, he'd be ahead of him in wins above average and pretty close to him on WAR. So for me, one more good year would do it, but I think Sabathia's still on top. Cliff Lee is Number three on the list, if we're talking, I guess the question was phrased as like best Indians pitchers of the 2000s, but I think he's a pretty distant third.
Who do we actually put as number three then? If it's best Indians pitchers of the 2000s, is it like Carrasco?
No, I think
it's been good long enough.
I think it is Lee, but I think he's pretty far back. I think Sabathia.
I don't know. Roberto Hernandez, anybody?
I think you mean Fausto Carmona.
I mean, you can make a case that Carrasco deserves to be fourth at this point. If we were doing like a Indians 2000 starting rotation, I think Carrasco's probably in it. And then, I don't know, you round that out with maybe Westbrook.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Sure, a lot of people have.
But I think Sabathia and Kluber are much closer together among the three guys that were mentioned in the question.
Yeah.
And really, I mean, I think when you talk about who's better, Sabathia or Kluber, you're not, I mean, that question, that's the same answer, I think, whether you're talking about Indians pitchers of the last 15 years or last 40 years or so. I mean, it's not like there was someone, you know, Nagy and Bartolo Colon would be up there, but I think Sabathia is the top guy, you know, going back to like Gaylord Perry's crazy short stint when he put up just bonkers numbers with the Indians in the early 70s.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, I was trying to think, like, there's nobody above Cliff Lee. You're right.
Well, we haven't had a ton of dominant starters in that stretch. I mean, we had Colon until we traded him, and then it was a little rough, and it was basically Sabathia. I mean, maybe you can throw in there Justin Masterson. He had a pretty good stretch for us. He was our opening day starter for like 3 years, but then, you know, he fell off the edge of the earth.
And Masterson, I think he's still in Boston. Masterson's a weird case because he had like three good years with the Indians and then two really bad years with the Indians. Mm-hmm. He's another guy also kind of, there's a big swing for him based on where you look. But he pitched like 5 years for the Indians. Baseball Reference only has his time with the Indians worth 7 wins.
Yeah.
So they've got him pretty far back of those other guys.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, like, thinking back, I must only remember the good times for Justin Masterson, because I remember really liking him, and then I go look at his stats and I'm like, yeah, oh, that wasn't as good as I remember. But yeah, I remember liking watching Masterson. And the other thing I was going to say is, kind of speaking of Fausto, Roberto Hernandez Carmona, there's this YouTube channel that I'm sure illegally uploads like old games, and there's one from like 2008 or 2009 or something, whenever it was still Fausto, he was like walking a ton of batters against the Tigers, and they were talking about, he's gonna be an ace, he's gonna get those walks down, and I was like, no. No, he's not. We want that to happen, but it's not gonna happen at all. It's gonna be the opposite. That was fun. Those YouTube channels are the best. I'm sure they're very illegal and I very shouldn't promote them, but like, they leave the commercials in and everything, so like watching 80s games is a lot of fun. I don't know, I like that old stuff, and I use it as background noise. It's really cool. So I think that's all our questions. We had quite a few. There's a couple extras, but we're pushing an hour here. So yeah, Brian, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, and I'm looking forward to Prospect Chat tomorrow, where I will be debuting my top 10 prospect ranking.
Oh yeah. And then you can always find you can find Jason on Let's Go Tribe too, but as mentioned, you can find Brian. You're going to be doing a lot of the prospect, the vote posts and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So we'll be seeing your name a lot more. You get to make all those fun polls every day.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yep. Jason, anything else that you're fun doing? Anything else fun that you're doing in the next week?
I'm on my second week of winter break, so that's fun. But I've got a crib to assemble, a changing table to assemble, a rug to go get. I've got a baby's room to put together, so that's going to be most of my week.
Did you enjoy your last semi-quiet holiday?
Yeah, I did. I got sick like 2 days after Christmas, so that was fun. But Christmas was fun. New Year's was good. The in-between was a little iffy.
So before I mention the next thing, are you guys still down for doing the post-show thing?
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So everybody's listening live now. I'm going to say goodbye here in a minute, but I am a liar. That's the goodbye for the podcast. The music's going to play for them and everything. They're going to be gone. It's going to shut off. It's going to go to their music, whatever they're listening to. But if you're here live, we're going to talk about Star Wars, because we all finally saw Rogue One. I was probably the last one to see it. I saw it the day after Christmas, I think. I know Jason saw it the night of. I'm sure, Brian, you probably saw it pretty
soon. I saw it opening weekend on Saturday, and then I watched it again after Christmas with my brother and sister.
So we were all waiting for me, but now we're going to finally watch it. And everybody who's not listening live, if you do want to hear it, maybe I'll do it as like an extra on the podcast stream. But at the very least, it'll be on our YouTube page, which We don't have a custom URL yet, but go on YouTube, search Let's Go Tribe, and you'll find us. But yeah, thanks for listening to the show. We will talk to you next week.